else at once. But if everybody thinks that it's best to leave her where she is for the moment, I insist on paying her fees. After all, she's going to be my sister soon. He took my hand in his. Promise to let me help. I looked at him helplessly. I don't know what to say.
Then don't say anything. All you have to do is promise to think about handing your notice in. I don't want to never see you once we're married. Now, what sort of house would you like?
I need to know because, if you'll let me, I'd like to buy you the house of your dreams as a wedding present.
I've never really thought about it, I admitted.
Well, think about it now because it's important. Would you like a big garden, a swimming pool, lots of bedrooms?
A big garden, definitely. I'm not bothered about a swimming pool. And as for the number of bedrooms, it depends how many children we're going to have.
Quite a lot, then, he smiled.
I'd like to live in Surrey, near enough to London to make the commute each day bearable. What do you think?
Anywhere, as long as you're happy. What about you? What sort of house would you like?
I'd like it to be near a pretty town, but far enough away for us not to be disturbed by noise.
Like you, I'd like it to have a big garden, preferably with high walls around it so that nobody can see in. And I'd like a study and a basement to keep things in. That's about it, really.
A nice kitchen, I said. I'd like a nice kitchen leading onto a terrace where we could have breakfast each morning. And a huge fireplace in the sitting room where we can have real log fires. And a yellow bedroom for Millie.
Why don't we draw up a plan of our dream house? He suggested, taking a sheet of paper from his briefcase. Then I'll have something to work with.
By the time he put me in a taxi 2 hours later, he'd made a drawing of a beautiful house, complete with landscaped gardens, a terrace, 3 reception rooms, a fireplace, a kitchen, a study, 5 bedrooms, including a yellow one for Millie, 3 bathrooms, and a little round window in the roof.
I defy you to find such a house by the time I get back from Argentina, I laughed.
I'll do my very best, he promised before giving me a kiss. The next few weeks passed in a whirlwind. When I got back from Argentina, I handed in my notice and put my house on the market. I had used my time away to think things over carefully and never doubted that I'd be doing the right thing if I did as Jack had asked. I knew that I wanted to marry him, and the thought that by the following spring I'd be living in a beautiful house in the country and maybe expecting our first baby filled me with excitement. I'd been working non-stop for 13 years, and there'd been times when I'd wondered if I'd ever be able to get off the treadmill. And because I'd known that once Millie came to live with me, I'd no longer be able to travel as I had, or work the long hours that I sometimes worked, I'd been nervous about what sort of job I'd end up with. Suddenly, all my worries disappeared, and as I chose wedding invitations to send out to family and friends, I felt I was the luckiest person in the world.
Present. Jack, meticulous as always, comes up to the bedroom at 10:30 in the morning and tells me we'll be leaving at 11 o'clock precisely. I'm not worried that I won't be ready in time. I've already showered, so 30 minutes is long enough to dress and put on my makeup. The shower calmed me down a little as, since waking at 8, I've been in a continuous state of excitement, hardly daring to believe that I'll soon be seeing Millie. Ever cautious, I remind myself that anything could happen. Yet the face I present to Jack shows nothing of my inner turmoil. It is calm and composed, and as he stands back to let me pass, I am just an ordinary young woman about to go on a day out. Jack follows me into the bedroom next door, where my clothes hang. I walk over to the huge wardrobe that runs the length of the wall, slide back the mirrored door,
pull out one of the drawers and select the cream-coloured bra and matching knickers, which Jack bought me last week. In another drawer, I find some flesh-coloured stockings, which I prefer to tights. Jack watches from a chair while I take off my pyjamas and put on my underwear and stockings. Then I slide back the next door and stand for a moment, looking at all the clothes hanging neatly by colour. I haven't worn my blue dress in a long time, and it is one that Millie loves because it's the same colour as my eyes. I take it out of the wardrobe. "Wear the cream one," Jack says. It's true that he prefers me in neutral colours, so I put the blue dress back and put on the cream one. My shoes are stored in clear boxes on shelves in another part of the wardrobe. I choose a pair of beige shoes with a heel. As we usually go for a walk after lunch, flat ones would be more practical, but Jack likes me to be elegant at all times, whether we're walking around a lake or having dinner with friends. I slip them on, take a matching bag from the shelf and hand it to Jack. I walk over to the dressing table and sit down. It doesn't take me long to do my makeup. A little bit of eye pencil, some blusher, and a dash of lipstick. There are still 15 minutes left, so to fill the time, I decide to wear some nail varnish. I choose a pretty pink from the various bottles arranged on the dresser, wishing I could take it with me and paint Millie's nails, something I know she would love. When it's dry, I stand up, take my bag from Jack, and go downstairs. "Which coat would you like to wear?" he asks as we reach the hall. "My beige wool, I think." He fetches it from the cloakroom and helps me on with it. I button it up and turn out the pockets while Jack looks on. He opens the front door and, once he's locked it behind us, I follow him out to the car. Although we are almost at the end of March, the air is cold. My instinct is to draw it in hard through my nose and gulp it down. Instead, I remind myself that I have the whole day in front of me, and rejoice in that thought. This trip out has been hard won, and I intend to make the most of it. As we reach the car, Jack activates the remote control, and the huge black gates that front our house begin to open. Walking around to the passenger side of the car, he opens my door for me. I get in, and a man jogging past the house looks through the gates towards us. I don't know him, but Jack wishes him a good morning and, either because he's too out of breath to speak or because he's saving energy for the rest of his run, the man acknowledges the greeting with a wave of his hand. Jack closes my door behind me and, less than a minute later, we drive out through the gates. As they swing shut behind us, I turn my head for a glimpse of the beautiful house Jack bought for me, because I like to see it as others see it. We begin the journey into London, and as we drive along, my mind goes back to the dinner party we hosted last night. How I managed to pull it off is still a mystery, when there were so many things that could have gone wrong. "Your souffle were perfect," Jack says, telling me that I'm not the only one thinking about the previous evening. "It was clever of you to predict a delay in getting to the table and allow for it in your calculations. Very clever indeed." "But Esther doesn't seem to like you very much. I wonder why that is." I know I need to choose my words carefully. "She doesn't appreciate perfection," I say. It's an answer that pleases him. He begins to hum a little tune, and as I look at the passing landscape, I find myself thinking about Esther. Under other circumstances, I would probably like her. But her undoubted intelligence makes her dangerous to someone like me. It's not that she doesn't appreciate perfection, as I first thought. It's more that she's suspicious of it. It takes the best part of an hour to reach Millie's school. I spend the time thinking about Dina Anderson, Jack's client. I don't know much about her, apart from the fact that she recently married a wealthy philanthropist, well-respected for his work with various charities, and therefore an unlikely candidate in the wife-battering stakes. Still, I know only too well how appearances can be deceiving. And if Jack has agreed to take her on as a client, she must have a very strong case. Losing is not a word in Jack's vocabulary, as he never ceases to remind me. We haven't seen Millie for a month, so, impatient to see me, she's waiting on the bench outside the front door, wrapped up in a yellow hat and scarf. Yellow is her favourite colour, with Janice, her carer. When I get out of the car, she rushes over, her eyes bright with tears of relief, and as I hug her tightly, I'm aware of Jack watching us. Janice joins us, and I hear Jack telling her that although we knew Millie would be disappointed, we hadn't dared to come and see her until I had completely recovered from the bout of flu that had laid me so low. Janice reassures him that we did the right thing, adding that she had explained to Millie why we couldn't come. But it was very hard for her, she admits. She adores you both so much. And we adore her, Jack says, smiling fondly at Millie. Say hello to Jack, Millie, I remind her quietly, and, disentangling herself, she turns to Jack. Hello, Jack, she says, giving him a big smile. I'm happy to see you. And I'm very happy to see you too, he says, kissing her cheek. You do understand why we couldn't come before, don't you? Millie nods. Yes, poor Grace ill, but better now. Much better, Jack agrees. I have something for you. For being so patient. He puts his hand into his coat pocket. Can you guess what it is?
Agatha Christie!
Her brown eyes light up with pleasure, as there's nothing she loves more than listening to murder mysteries.
Clever girl.
He takes an audiobook from his pocket. I don't think you've gotten Then There Were None, have you? She shakes her head.
It's one of my favourites, Janice says, smiling. Shall we start it tonight, Millie?
Yes, Millie nods.
Thank you, Jack.
It's my pleasure, Jack tells her. And now I'm going to take my two favourite ladies out to lunch. Where would you like to go?
Hotel, says Millie immediately.
I know why she's chosen the hotel, just as I know why Jack is going to refuse. Why don't we go to the restaurant by the lake, he says, as if she hadn't spoken, or the one that serves those delicious pancakes for dessert. Millie's face falls. Which would you prefer?
The lake,
she mutters, her dark hair swinging in front of her face. Millie doesn't talk much on the way. She had wanted me to sit in the back of the car with her, but Jack told her he would feel as if he was a taxi driver. When we arrive at the restaurant, Jack finds a parking space, and as we walk up the path, he takes our hands so that we're on either side of him. The staff greets us like old friends because we often bring Millie here. They show us to the round table in the corner, the one that Jack likes, by the window. We sit, as we always do, Jack facing the window and Millie and I sitting on either side of him. As we study our menus, I stretch my leg out under the table and find hers, my secret sign to her. Jack chats away to Millie during the meal, encouraging her to talk, asking her what she did during the weekends when we didn't come and see her. She tells us that once Janice took her back to hers for lunch, once they went out for afternoon tea, and once they were both invited to her friend Paige's house. And not for the first time. Thank God that Millie has someone like Janice to step in whenever I can't be with her.
Grace, come walk,
Millie asks once lunch is over.
Round lake?
Yes, of course. I fold my napkin neatly and place it on the table, my movements deliberately unhurried.
Shall we go now?
Jack pushes back his chair. I'll come too. Even though I didn't expect anything less, there is still a feeling of crushing disappointment.
We go all the way round, Millie warns.
Not all the way around, protests Jack. It's too cold. It's too cold to be outside for long.
Then Jack stay here, Millie tells him. I go with Grace.
No, says Jack. We'll all go. Millie looks solemnly at Jack from across the table.
I like you, Jack, she says.
But I don't like George Cooney.
I know, Jack nods. I don't like him either.
He ugly, says Millie.
Yes, he's very ugly, agrees Jack. And Millie bursts into fits of laughter.
We walk a little way around the lake, Jack walking between me and Millie. Jack tells Millie that he's very busy getting her room ready for when she comes to live with us. And when she asks if it's going to be yellow, he says that of course it is. He was right. It is too cold to be outside for very long. And after about 20 minutes, we head back to the car. Millie is even quieter on the way back to her school. And I know she feels the same frustration that I feel. When we say goodbye, she asks if we'll be back to see her the following weekend. And when Jack says he's sure we will be, I'm glad that Janice is within earshot. Past. When Jack and I told Millie that we were getting married, the first thing she asked was if she could be our bridesmaid. Of course you can, I said, hugging her. That's all right, isn't it, Jack? I added, dismayed to see a frown on his face.
I thought we were having a simple wedding, he said pointedly.
We are, but I'll still need a bridesmaid.
Really?
Well, yes, I said, feeling flustered. It's traditional. You don't mind, do you?
Don't you think it'll be a bit much for Millie? He asked, lowering his voice. If you really need a bridesmaid, why not ask Kate or Emily?
Because I want Millie, I insisted, aware of her watching us anxiously. There was a moment's awkward silence.
Then Millie you shall have, he said, smiling and holding his arm out to her. Come on, let's go and tell your headmistress the good news.
Mrs. Goodrich and Janice were delighted to hear we were getting married. After sending Millie off to wash her hands in preparation for dinner, Mrs. Goodrich agreed that it would be best if Millie stayed at school for another 15 months, until she turned 18, as had been planned all along, despite Jack reiterating that he would be quite happy to have Millie move in with us at once. I was glad when Mrs. Goodrich suggested it would be nice for us to have some time on our own, and I wondered if maybe she'd guessed that we hoped to start a family straight away. Soon after, we were on our way to Hecclescombe, where Cranley Park was every bit as beautiful as Jack had told me it was. It was the perfect setting for a wedding, and I was grateful to Giles and Moira, Jack's friends, for allowing us to use their beautiful home. We didn't think any of our guests would mind the 40-minute drive from London to be able to spend the afternoon and evening in such a lovely setting, especially as Giles and Moira kindly offered to put up anyone who couldn't face the drive back to London once dinner was over. After a couple of hours spent deciding on a menu for 50, which would be cooked and served by a catering company from London, we left for the hotel Jack had booked while I'd been in Argentina. I couldn't wait for Jack to take me to bed at last, but dinner had to be got through first, because we only just arrived in time for our reservation. The meal was delicious, but I was impatient to be back in our room. I went off to have a shower, and when I came out of the bathroom, eager to make love, I was dismayed to find Jack sound asleep on the bed. I didn't have the heart to wake him, as I knew he was exhausted. He had confessed to me during dinner that he had almost cancelled our weekend away because of the amount of work he had on, but hadn't wanted to let me down. When he eventually stirred a couple of hours later, he was mortified that he'd fallen asleep, and, gathering me in his arms, he made love to me. We stayed in bed for most of the next morning, and after a lazy lunch, we headed back to London. Even though it meant that I didn't see Jack for the whole of the following week, I was glad we'd managed to take some time out from the frenzy our imminent wedding had precipitated us into. And not being able to see Jack gave me the chance to finish the painting I'd started for him 2 months previously. Because I had rarely the time to work on it, I'd resigned myself to giving it to him as a wedding present rather than for Christmas, as I'd wanted to do. But with Jack busy in the evenings, and my suitcases consigned indefinitely to the back of the cupboard,
I managed to complete it in time for Christmas Day. I hoped that if he liked it, it would grace the walls of our new home. I could easily imagine it hanging above the fireplace we'd talked about having. It was a large painting, and at first glance, it seemed to be an abstract design of different shades of red, with tiny spots of silver running through it. It was only on closer inspection that one could distinguish the mass of red as hundreds of tiny fireflies, and only Jack and I would know that the mass of red had been created not from paint, but from lipstick, which I had then sealed with a clear varnish before completing the painting. I had never told Jack that I enjoyed painting, and even when he had admired one of the canvases that hung in my kitchen, I hadn't mentioned that I was the artist. So when I told him on Christmas Day, once I was certain he liked the painting I'd given him, that not only had I painted fireflies myself, but that I'd created it by kissing the canvas hundreds of times wearing different shades of red lipstick, he lavished so many compliments on me that I was pleased I'd managed to surprise him. He was delighted that I could paint and told me that once we moved into our house, he would expect me to cover the walls with my work. My house sold quickly. I wanted Jack to put the money I received from the sale towards the house he'd found us in Spring Eaton, but he refused, reminding me that it was his wedding present to me. He had discovered the sleepy village of Spring Eaton whilst driving back from Adam and Diane's one Sunday and found its situation some 20 miles south of London ideal. Because there was some minor work to be done to the house before we moved in, he didn't want me to see it until we came back from our honeymoon. When I badgered him to tell me what it was like, he simply smiled and told me it was perfect. When I asked him if it was like the one in the picture we'd drawn up together, he replied solemnly that of course it was. I told him that I wanted to use the money from the sale of my house to furnish our new home as my wedding present to him, and after a lot of persuasion, he agreed. It was strange shopping for furniture for a house I'd never seen, but Jack knew exactly what he wanted, and I couldn't fault his taste. I left my job a month before we were due to be married, and a week later, after I complained teasingly to Jack that the novelty of not having anything to do all day long was wearing off, he appeared on my doorstep, carrying a box tied with a red bow. Opening it, I found a 3-month-old Labrador puppy staring up at me. "Jack, she's adorable," I cried, lifting her out. "Where did you get her? Is she yours?" "No, she's yours," he said. "Something to keep you busy." "She'll certainly do that," I laughed. I put her down on the ground and she ran around the hall, exploring everything. But I don't understand what I'm meant to do with her while we're on honeymoon in Thailand. We could ask my parents to have her, I suppose, but I'm not sure they'd agree. "Don't worry, it's all arranged. I've found a housekeeper to look after our house while we're away. I don't want it lying empty, and there's still some furniture to be delivered, so she's going to live in until we get back. And she's going to look after Molly for us." "Molly?" I looked at the puppy. "Yes, it suits her very well. Millie will be so pleased. She's always wanted a dog. Millie and Molly, they sound perfect together." "It's exactly what I thought," Jack nodded. "Millie is going to love her. And you? Will you love her?" "Of course I will." I scooped her into my arms. "I already do." I laughed as she began to lick my face. "I'm afraid I'm going to hate leaving her behind when we go to Thailand." "But just think how pleased you'll be to see her again when we get back. I can already picture your reunion." He smiled. "I can't wait to show her to Millie. You're so wonderfully kind, Jack." Leaning towards him, I kissed him tenderly. "Molly is exactly what I need to keep me company while you're at work all day. I hope there are some lovely places to walk in Spring Eaton." "There are plenty, especially along the river." "I can't wait," I told him happily. "I can't wait to see the house, and I can't wait to be married to you." "Neither can I," he said, kissing me back. "Neither can I." With Molly to keep me on my toes, the final weeks flew by. On the day before the wedding, I picked Millie up from school and we dropped Molly off with Jack, who was taking her down to the house that evening to settle her in with the housekeeper. I hated leaving her, but Jack assured me that Mrs. Johns, the lady he'd found to house-sit for us, was wonderfully kind and was happy to look after Molly until our return from Thailand. I'd moved into a nearby hotel a few days earlier, after I'd seen the last of my possessions disappear off to Spring Eaton in a removal van, so Millie and I went back there to prepare for the next day. We spent the evening making sure our dresses fitted perfectly and trying out makeup I'd bought especially for the wedding. I hadn't wanted to wear a traditional wedding dress, so I'd bought a cream silk dress that reached almost to my ankles and clung to my figure in all the right places. And Millie had chosen a cream dress too, but with a pink sash, the exact colour of the bouquet she'd carry. When I put my dress on the next morning, I'd never felt so beautiful. The wedding bouquets had arrived at the hotel earlier, pink roses for Millie and a cascade of deep red ones for me. Jack had organised a car to take us to the registry office, and when there was a knock on the door at 11 the next morning, I sent Millie to answer it. "Tell them I'll be out in a minute," I said, disappearing into the bathroom to check myself one last time in the mirror. Satisfied with what I saw, I went back into the bedroom and picked up my bouquet. "You look stunning." Startled, I looked up and saw Jack standing in the doorway. He looked so handsome in his dark suit and deep red waistcoat that my stomach flipped over. Almost as beautiful as Millie, in fact. Next to him, Millie clapped her hands happily. "What are you doing here?" I cried, anxious and delighted at the same time. "Has something happened?" He came over and took me in his arms. "I couldn't wait to see you, that's all. And also, I have something for you." Releasing me, he put his hand in his pocket and drew out a black box. "I went to the bank this morning to fetch them." Opening the box, I saw an exquisite pearl necklace lying on a bed of black velvet with a matching pair of pearl earrings. "Jack, they're beautiful." "They belong to my mother. I'd forgotten all about them until last night. I thought you might want to wear them today, which is why I came over. You don't have to, of course." "I'd love to wear them," I told him, lifting out the necklace and undoing the clasp. "Here, let me." He took them from me and slipped them around my neck. "What do you think?" I turned towards the mirror. "I can't believe how perfectly they match the dress," I said, fingering them. "They're exactly the same shade of cream." I unclipped the gold earrings I was wearing and replaced them with the pearls. "Grace, pretty, very, very pretty," Millie laughed. "I agree," said Jack gravely. He put his hand in his other pocket and drew out a smaller box. "I have something for you too, Millie." When Millie saw the tear-shaped pearl on the silver chain, she gave a gasp of delight. "Thank you, Jack," she said, beaming. "I wear it now." "You're so kind, Jack," I told him as I put it around Millie's neck. "But did you know it's supposed to be bad luck to see your bride on her wedding day?" "Well, I guess I'll just have to take my chance," he smiled. "How's Molly? Did she settle in all right?" "Perfectly. Look." He took his phone out of his pocket and showed Millie and me a photograph of Molly curled up asleep in her basket. "So the floor has tiles," I mused. "At least I know one thing about my future home." "And that's all you're going to know," he said, pocketing his phone. "Now, shall we go? The chauffeur was surprised enough when I asked him to pick me up on the way to collect you, so if we don't go out soon, he might think I've come to call the whole thing off." After offering me and Millie an arm each, he escorted us down to the car, and we set off for the registry office. When we arrived, everyone was there waiting for us, including my parents. They had all but boxed up their house in preparation for their move to New Zealand, and were set to leave a fortnight after we got back from our honeymoon. I'd been a bit surprised when they told me they were leaving so soon, but when I thought about it, they'd waited a long 16 years. The previous week, Jack and I had met them for dinner, where they had officially signed Millie over to us, which meant that we were now her legal guardians. All of us were delighted by this arrangement, and my parents, perhaps because they felt guilty about Jack shouldering the financial burden, told us that they would of course help out in any way they could. But Jack was adamant that he and I would be responsible for Millie, and promised my parents that she would want for nothing. Our guests were surprised to see Jack stepping out of the car alongside Millie and me, and as we set off up the flight of steps that led to the registry office, they teased him good-naturedly about not being able to resist riding in a Rolls-Royce. Dad was escorting me, and Jack was escorting Millie, and my Uncle Leonard, whom I hadn't seen for several years, had given Mum his arm. I was almost at the top of the steps when I heard Millie cry out and, spinning round, saw her tumbling down the steps. "Millie!" I screamed. By the time she came to a stop in a crumpled heap at the bottom of the steps, I was already halfway there. It seemed an age before I managed to push through the throng of people gathered around her, and I knelt down beside her, not caring that my dress was getting dirty, only caring that Millie was lying there, motionless. "It's all right, Grace. She's breathing," Adam said reassuringly from where he crouched on the other side of her as I searched frantically for a pulse. "She'll be fine, you see. Diane's phoning for an ambulance. They'll be here in a minute." "What happened?" I asked, my voice shaking, aware of Mum and Dad crouching down next to me. I stroked Millie's hair back from her face, not daring to move her. "Grace, I'm so sorry." I looked up and saw Jack, his face white as a sheet. "She suddenly stumbled. I think her heel got caught in the hem of her dress, and before I knew what was happening, she was falling. I tried to grab her, but I couldn't reach her." "It's all right," I said quickly. "It's not your fault." "I should have held on to her more tightly," he went on desperately, running his hands through his hair. "I should have remembered that steps aren't always easy for her." "Oh, I don't like the way her leg is bent," Dad said quietly. "Looks as if it's broken." "Oh, God," I moaned. "Look, she's coming round." Mum took Millie's hand in hers. "It's all right, Millie," I murmured as she began to stir. "It's all right." The ambulance arrived in minutes. I wanted to go to the hospital with her, but Mum and Dad told me they would go, reminding me that I was meant to be getting married.
I can't get married now,"
I sobbed as Millie was carried into the ambulance. "Of course you can," said Mum briskly. "Millie's going to be fine."
"She has a broken leg," I wept, "and maybe other injuries we don't know about."
"I won't blame you if you want to call it off," Jack said quietly.
"It's just that I don't see how we can go ahead with everything when we don't even know how badly injured Millie is."
The paramedics were wonderful. Understanding what a difficult situation I was in, they examined Millie as thoroughly as they could in the ambulance and told me that, apart from her leg, there didn't seem to be any other broken bones, and that if I wanted to carry on with my wedding, they were sure my parents could keep me informed of any developments. They also pointed out that as soon as Millie arrived at the hospital, she would be whisked away for x-rays, so I wouldn't be able to stay with her anyway. Still torn, I looked over to where Jack was standing, talking quietly to Adam, and the look of desolation on his face decided me. I clambered into the ambulance and kissed a drowsy Millie goodbye. After promising I would go and see her the next morning, I gave my parents Jack's mobile number, because mine was in my case, and asked them to let me know as soon as they had any news.
"Are you sure you still want to go ahead?" Jack asked anxiously once the ambulance had left. "I don't suppose anyone particularly feels like celebrating after what happened to Millie. Maybe we should wait until we know that she's definitely going to be all right."
I looked at our guests, who were milling about, needing to know if our wedding was still taking place or not. "I think they'll be fine with it if we are." I turned him to face me. Jack, do you still want to get married?
Of course I do. More than anything. But ultimately, it's your decision.
Then let's get married. It's what Millie would want,
I lied. Because I knew Millie wouldn't understand why we had gone ahead and got married without her. The feeling that I was betraying her made fresh tears well in my eyes, and I blinked them away quickly so that Jack wouldn't see, hoping I'd never have to choose between him and Millie again. Everyone was delighted that we were getting married after all, and when Mum phoned a couple of hours later to tell us that Millie was fine apart from a broken leg, I felt weak with relief. I wanted to cut the reception short and go to see her that evening, but Mum said that she was sleeping soundly and, with the painkillers the doctor had given her, she wasn't expected to wake up until the following morning anyway. She added that she intended to stay at the hospital overnight, so I told her that Jack and I would stop off to see Millie the next morning on the way to the airport. Although I managed to enjoy myself for the rest of the evening, I was glad when the last of our guests had left, and Jack and I were finally on our way to our hotel. Because Jack's car was still in London, Moira and Giles had lent us one of theirs so that we could get to the airport the next day and back to Spring Eaton when we returned from Thailand. With a garage full of cars, they insisted that they didn't need it and said we could drop it back whenever we had time. When we arrived at the hotel where we were to spend our wedding night, I went straight to the bathroom and ran myself a hot bath, leaving Jack to pour himself a whiskey while he waited for me. As I lay in the bath, my mind turned again and again to Millie, and I couldn't help being glad that the day was finally over. With the water beginning to get cold, I got out and dried myself hurriedly, eager to see Jack's face when he saw me in the cream silk camisole and knickers I'd bought specially for our wedding night. I slipped them on and, with a shiver of anticipation, opened the door and walked into the bedroom. Present. On the way home in the car from seeing Millie, I mentioned to Jack that I'm going to have to phone Diane sometime before Friday to tell her that I can't make lunch with her and Esther. On the contrary, I think you should go, he says. Because he said the same thing many times before, I know it doesn't mean anything. After all, you've already cancelled twice. Even those words aren't enough to get my hopes up. But on Friday morning, when he tells me to put on my prettiest dress, I can't help wondering if the moment I've been waiting for has finally come. My mind races so far ahead that I have to remind myself firmly of all the other times I've ended up disappointed. Even when I get into the car beside Jack, I still don't let myself believe that it might happen. But when we drive all the way into town, I can't help but believe it, and I begin to plot feverishly, terrified that I'll let the moment slip through my fingers. It's only when Jack parks the car in the road outside the restaurant and gets out that I realise how deluded I've been. Diane and Esther are already seated. Diane waves and I make my way over, a smile hiding my bitter disappointment, conscious of Jack's hand on my back. I'm so glad you could make it, she says, giving me a quick hug. Jack, how nice of you to come and say hello. Is it your lunch hour? I worked from home this morning, he says, and as I don't have to be in the office until later this afternoon, I was hoping you'd let me gatecrash your lunch. In exchange for me treating you, of course. In that case, you can join us with pleasure, she laughs. I'm sure it won't be any trouble to add an extra place, especially as it's a table for four. Except that we won't be able to talk about you now, Esther jokes. As Jack purloins a chair from another table, it occurs to me that had she wanted to say anything more damaging, she wouldn't have been able to. Not that it really matters anymore. I'm sure you've got far more interesting things to talk about than me, Jack smiles, placing me opposite Esther and signalling to the waitress to bring another place setting.
And Grace would only have nice things to say about you anyway, so it wouldn't be much fun. Diane sighs. Oh, I'm sure she'd be able to find a few little imperfections. Esther looks at me challengingly. Wouldn't you, Grace?
I doubt it, I say. As you can see, Jack is pretty perfect.
Come on, he can't be that perfect. There must be something.
I furrow my brow, making a show of giving it some thought, then shake my head regretfully. No, sorry, I really can't think of anything. Unless buying me too many flowers counts. Sometimes it's hard to find enough vases to put them in.
Beside me, Diane groans. Oh, that is not a fault, Grace. She turns to Jack. I don't suppose you could give Adam a few tips on how to spoil one's wife, could you?
Don't forget that Grace and Jack are practically newlyweds compared to us all, Esther points out. And they don't have any children yet. Gallantry tends to fly out of the window once familiarity and babies install themselves in a relationship. She pauses a moment.
Did you live together long before you got married?
We didn't have time to live together, Jack explains. We got married less than 6 months after we met. Esther raises her eyebrows.
Gosh, that was quick.
Once I knew Grace was the one for me, there didn't seem to be any point in hanging around, he says, taking my hand. Esther looks over at me, a smile playing at the corner of her mouth.
And you didn't find any skeletons in the closet once you were married?
Not a single one. I take the menu the waitress holds out to me and open it eagerly. Not only because I want to stop Esther's interrogation of my relationship with Jack, but also because I'm hungry. I scan the dishes on offer and see that their fillet steak comes with mushrooms, onions, and French fries. Perfect.
Is anybody having anything remotely fattening? Diane asks hopefully.
Esther shakes her head.
Sorry, I'm going for a salad.
I'm having the fillet steak, I tell her, with fries, and I'll probably have the chocolate fudge cake for dessert, I add, knowing that that's what she wants to hear.
In that case, I'll join Esther in the salad and you in the fudge cake, she says happily.
Would anybody like wine? Jack asks, ever the perfect host.
No, thank you, says Diane, and regretfully, I resign myself to an alcohol-free lunch because Jack never drinks during the day.
I'd love some, says Esther, but only if you and Grace have some too.
I won't, says Jack. I have a lot to do this afternoon.
I will, I tell Esther. Would you prefer red or white?
The conversation, while we're waiting to be served, turns to the local music festival, which takes place every July and draws people from miles around. We agree that where we all live, we're near enough to be able to attend the festival easily, yet far enough away to not be disturbed by the thousands of people that descend on the town. Although Diane and Adam always go to the festival, Jack and I have never been, and we're soon drawn into Diane's plans for all of us to go together. In talking about music, we learn that Esther plays the piano and Rufus the guitar, and when I admit to not being at all musical, Esther asks me if I like reading, and I tell her I do, although I do very little. We talk about the sort of books we like, and Esther mentions a new bestseller that has just come out and asks if we've read it. It turns out that none of us have.
Would you like me to lend it to you? She asks as the waitress puts our meals on the table.
Yes, please. I'm so touched that she's offered to lend her book to me rather than to Diane that I forget.
I'll drop it round this afternoon, she offers. I don't teach on Fridays.
Now I remember.
You might have to leave it in the letterbox. If I'm in the garden, which I probably will be, I won't hear the bell.
I'd love to see a garden sometime, she enthuses, especially after what Jack said about you having green fingers.
There's no need for you to drive over, says Jack, neatly sidestepping the massive hint she's just dropped. Grace can buy the book for herself.
It's really no problem. Esther eyes her salad appreciatively.
Gosh, this looks lovely.
In fact, we'll go and buy a copy as soon as we've finished here. Smith's is just round the corner. Is it just on Fridays that you don't work? I ask, wanting to change the subject.
No, I don't work Tuesdays either.
One of the other teachers and I job share.
Oh, I'd love to be able to do that, says Diane wistfully.
It's hard working full-time when you've got children.
But I'd hate to give up working altogether, which is the only alternative, because my firm haven't heard of job sharing yet.
Esther looks over at me. Can't believe you don't miss working. I mean, you had a pretty exciting job before you got married. I busy myself cutting a piece of steak, because it's hard being reminded of the life I used to have.
Not at all. I have plenty to keep me occupied.
So, what are your other hobbies, then, apart from painting, gardening and reading?
Oh, bit of this, a bit of that, I say, realising how lame it sounds.
What Grace hasn't told you is that she makes a lot of her own clothes, Jack intervenes. Just the other day, she made herself a lovely dress.
Really?
Esther looks at me with interest. Used to thinking on my feet, I don't bat an eyelid. It was just a dress to wear around the house, I explain. Nothing fancy. I don't make clothes to wear out in the evening or anything too complicated.
I didn't know you were good with a needle.
Diane's eyes gleam.
I'd love to be able to sew.
Me too, says Esther.
Perhaps you could teach me, Grace.
Maybe we could start a sewing circle with you as our teacher, Diane suggests.
I'm really not that good, I protest, which is why I've never mentioned it before. I'm too worried people will ask to see something I've made.
Well, if you sew anything like you cook, I'm sure the dress you made is beautiful.
You have to show it to us sometime, Esther says.
I will, I promise, but only if you don't ask me to make you one. The constant need to field her remarks makes me feel so tense that I consider skipping dessert, something I wouldn't normally do. But if I don't have one, Diane won't. And because Esther has just professed herself too full to eat another thing, it means that the meal can be rounded up quickly. I weigh the pros and cons, but in the end, the lure of chocolate fudge cake is too strong. I take another sip of wine, hoping to stave off more of Esther's questioning, wishing she would turn her attention to Diane for a while. As if reading my mind, she asks Diane about her son. His eating habits is one of Diane's favourite topics of conversation, so I get a few minutes' reprieve while the conversation revolves around how best to get children to eat vegetables they don't like. Jack listens attentively, as if the subject is of real interest to him, and my mind turns to Millie, worrying how she will take it if I'm not able to go and see her over the weekend, because it's getting harder and harder to explain my absences to her. Once, it would never have occurred to me to wish her to be any different to how she's always been. Now, I'm constantly wishing that she didn't have Downs, that she wasn't dependent on me, that she could live her own life instead of having to share mine. Called abruptly back to the present by Diane ordering my dessert for me, I tell Esther, when she asks what I was dreaming about, that I was thinking about Millie. Diane asks if we've seen her recently, so I tell her that we saw her the previous Sunday and that Jack took us out for a lovely lunch. I wait for someone to ask if we'll be going to see her again this weekend, but nobody does, so I'm none the wiser.
She must be looking forward to coming to live with you, Esther says as the desserts arrive.
Yes, she is, I agree. Jack smiles. We're looking forward to it too.
What does she think of the house?
I reach for my glass.
Actually, she hasn't seen it yet.
But didn't you move in a year ago?
Yes, but we want everything to be perfect before she sees it, Jack explains.
It looked pretty perfect to me when I saw it, she remarks.
Her room isn't quite finished yet, but I'm having so much fun doing it up, aren't I, darling? To my horror, I feel tears welling up inside me and bow my head quickly, conscious of Esther's eyes on me.
What colour will it be? Asks Diane.
Red, says Jack. It's her favourite colour. He nods at my chocolate fudge cake. Eat up, darling. I pick up my spoon, wondering how I'm going to be able to do as he says.
"Looks delicious," says Esther. "Don't suppose you want to share it with me, do you?"
I hesitate, feigning reluctance, wondering why I'm bothering because I won't have fooled Jack.
"Help yourself," I say, offering her my fork.
"Thank you." She spears a piece of the cake. "Did you and Jack come in separate cars?"
"No, we came together."
"Then I'll drop you back if you like."
"It's fine. I intend taking Grace home before going into the office," Jack says.
"Isn't that a bit of a detour?"
She frowns.
"You can get straight on the motorway to London from here. I'll take her home, Jack. It's really no problem."
"That's very kind of you. But there are some documents that I need to pick up before seeing one of my clients later this afternoon."
He pauses.
"It's a shame I didn't bring them with me, because I would have let you take Grace home with pleasure."
"Another time, then." Esther turns to me. "Grace, perhaps we can exchange telephone numbers? I'd like to have you all round to dinner, but I need to check with Rufus to see when he's free. He has a trip to Berlin coming up, and I'm not sure when it is."
"Of course."
I give her our home number, and she taps it into her mobile.
"And your mobile?"
"I don't have one."
She does a double take.
"You don't have a mobile?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because I don't see the need for one."
"But everybody over the age of 10 and under the age of 80 has one."
"Well, not me," I say, amused, despite myself, at her reaction.
"I know, it's incredible, isn't it?" says Diane. "I've tried to persuade her to buy one, but she isn't interested."
"But how on earth does anybody get hold of you when you're out and about?" wonders Esther.
I shrug.
"They don't."
"Which is quite a good thing," says Diane dryly. "I can't go shopping without Adam or one of the children phoning to ask me to get them something, to find out when I'll be back. The number of times I've been standing at the checkout in Tesco trying to load all my shopping into bags while trying to sort out something at home doesn't bear thinking about."
"But what if you have a problem?"
asks Esther, still trying to get her head round it.
"People managed perfectly well before without mobiles," I point out.
"Yes, back in the Dark Ages." She turns to Jack.
"Jack, buy your wife a mobile, for God's sake."
Jack opens his hands in a gesture of defeat.
"I'd be only too happy to. But I know that if I did, she wouldn't use it."
"I can't believe that. Not once she realises how practical they are."
"Jack's right, I wouldn't," I confirm.
"Please, tell me you have a computer."
"Yes, of course I do."
"Then could I have your email address?"
"Sure. It's jackangel@court.com.
Isn't that Jack's address?"
"It's mine too."
She raises her head and looks at me quizzically from across the table.
"Don't you have your own address?"
"What for?
Jack and I don't have any secrets from each other. And if people email me, it's usually to invite us for dinner or something else that concerns Jack too. So it's easier if he sees the messages as well."
"Especially as Grace often forgets to tell me things," Jack says, smiling indulgently at me. Esther looks thoughtfully at the two of us.
"You really are a joined-at-the-hip couple, aren't you? Well, as you haven't got a mobile, I suppose you'll have to resort to pen and paper to take my numbers down. Have you got a pen?"
"I know that I don't."
"I'm not sure," I say, intending to make a show of looking for one.
I reach for my bag, which I had slung over the back of my chair, but she gets there first and hands it to me.
"Goodness, it feels empty."
"I travel light," I tell her, opening my bag and peering inside.
"No, sorry, I don't have one."
"It's all right, I'll get them." Jack takes out his mobile. "I already have your home number, Esther, from Rufus, so if you just give me your mobile."
As she reels it off, I try desperately to commit it to memory, but I get lost somewhere near the end. I close my eyes and try to retrieve the last few numbers, but it's impossible.
"Thanks, Esther," says Jack.
I open my eyes and find Esther looking at me curiously from across the table.
"I'll write it down for Grace when we get home."
Wait a minute. Is it 721 or 712 in the middle?
Esther furrows her brow.
I can never remember which it is. The end is easy, though. 9146. It's the bit before I have a problem with. Could you just check, Diane?
Diane gets out her phone and locates Esther's number.
It's 712, she says. Oh, yes, so 07517 129 146. Did you get that, Jack?
Yes, it's fine. Right, anyone for coffee? But we don't bother because Diane has to get back to work and Esther doesn't want any. Jack asks for the bill and Diane and Esther disappear off to the toilet. I would like to go too, but I don't bother following them. The bill paid, Jack and I take leave of the others and walk towards the car park. Well, did you enjoy that, my perfect little wife? Jack asks, opening the car door for me. I recognise one of his million-dollar questions. Not really. Not even the dessert you were so looking forward to. I swallow hard. Not as much as I thought I would. It's lucky Esther was able to help you out then, wasn't it? I would have eaten it anyway, I tell him, and deprived me of so much pleasure. A tremor goes through my body. Absolutely. He raises his eyebrows. Do I detect a renewal of your fighting spirit? I'm so glad. To tell the truth, I've been getting quite bored. He gives me an amused glance. Bring it on, Grace. I'm waiting for you.
Past. That evening, the evening of my wedding day, when I stepped into the bedroom after my bath, I was dismayed to find it empty. Presuming that Jack had gone off to make a phone call, I felt irritated that something could be more important to him on our wedding day than me. But my irritation quickly turned to anxiety when I remembered that Millie was in hospital, and in the space of a couple of seconds, I managed to convince myself that something terrible had happened to her, that Mum had phoned Jack to tell him, and that he had left the room because he didn't want me to hear their conversation. I ran to the bedroom door and flung it open, expecting to see Jack pacing up and down the corridor, trying to work out how to break some tragic news to me. But it was empty. Guessing he had gone down to the lobby, and not wanting to waste time going to find him, I searched through my luggage, which had been dropped off at the hotel by the chauffeur, dug out my phone, and rang Mum's mobile. As I waited to be connected, it occurred to me that if she was talking to Jack, I wouldn't be able to get through to her anyway. I was about to hang up and call Dad's mobile instead, when I heard her phone ringing and, soon after, her voice. "Mum, what's happened?" I cried before she'd even finished saying hello. "Has there been a complication or something?"
"No, everything's fine."
Mum sounded surprised. "So Millie's all right?"
"Yes,